Tonight on Arena, Mark Frost, co-creator with David Lynch of Twin Peaks, and musician Amaravich on ditching violin for saxophone. Five one double 51 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. And yes, indeed, Sean Rocks, delighted to be back with you in the seat. And thanks very much to Rick O'Shea for minding the shop last week. The first couple of notes will do it for most people, I would say. Bring them right back to the 1980s and the 1990s and the phenomenon that was and is Twin Peaks, written by Mark Frost and David Lynch. Twin Peaks was a sensation from the very moment it first aired in 1989. Rooted in small-town America, blending cinematic and novelistic sensibilities, it redefined the possibilities of long-form TV drama. 35 years on from the original pilot screening and three series, one film and a number of books later, Twin Peaks is justifiably considered by many as one of the greatest TV shows of all time. And Mark Frost, who along with David Lynch created Twin Peaks, joins us now to explain why, if you can, Mark Frost, after 35 years, if you've worked out why it was such a success. Lovely to have you with us.
Thank you, Sean. It's a pleasure to be here. I think anybody would tell you they can remember where they were when they first heard that piece of music. Most of them were probably sitting in front of their TVs. I was fortunate enough to be in a room with Angelo and David and have it played for me in person. So it has special impact for me. It's a very pertinent question. And the answer, I think, has changed over the years. I think the simplest way to say it is that the audience was starved for some kind of poetic, mythic realism that television simply had not given them with any regularity or hardly at all. And we had this audacious idea that it was capable of much more and much better, and that we wanted to create a show that people would actually want to pay attention to and didn't want to have on in the background. So that's what we set about doing. And it's still early, but I would say I'm very encouraged by the returns after 30 years.
Yeah, I think it's going to do okay for you.
I think it has a chance.
Yeah. But, you know, in some ways, and you talk about a brilliant way of putting it, you know, something in the poetic and mythic realm. Because in many ways, now there are lots of little hints, even those first two notes on the guitar are a hint for us, in fact, that we're not in a normal type of television world. But at the beginning of the series, certainly there are huge elements in the opening sequence, in the opening pilot episode, of just a straightforward kind of, procedural, police procedural. What was the idea there in terms of, you know, you can't say, right, let's give them poetics and mystic realms from the very start? You had to start out, I suppose, traditionally enough.
We had to start out rooted in a procedural that felt familiar. It was, that was the skeleton key that was going to open the door to what we knew was waiting in the town. And the murder and the mystery around Laura Palmer's death became the vehicle to do that. And once we got that Trojan horse in the door, that's when the fun started and the hatch opened, and all the other things came tumbling out onto the ground.
Yeah, and I mean, I suppose it's important. You know, normally you wouldn't be saying after 35 years, spoiler alert. But we do have to say there will be some people watching Twin Peaks for the first time when it's released on in its entirety on Mubi this week. And boy, what a joy they are in for to see this for the first time. But, you know, I wondered how quickly did I kind of realise, and as I say, yeah, the first two notes on the guitar are a bit of a giveaway, but that's in hindsight. I think I was watching again today. Even when we see the body of Laura Palmer being found, this is, you know, perfect young woman from the perfect town, if such a thing ever existed in any country, never mind the United States. But, you know, I think even when I saw today, I was watching and the body wrapped in plastic, even that seemed to me, that must have been audacious at the time, lying on a shore, this body in a plastic sheet.
Well, it certainly wasn't the way that people were used to seeing an opening like this into a crime drama. And I think the way that David depicted her and obviously the incredible Cheryl Lee, who had just happened upon while casting the show in Seattle, it gave it a kind of fairy tale opening, a dark fairy tale. It wasn't just a corpse on a street. It was, I think you knew the moment you saw her that this was portending something a little bit more than what people were used to. And it certainly grabbed them. And then our job was to not let them go.
Yeah. And the next moment when I thought, do you know what? If people don't know by now that they're not in a normal police procedural, they should probably turn off. It's the point very, very early on. And we have Jack Nance as Pete Martell, who's calling the police department in Twin Peaks to make the terrible report of finding this body on the lake shore wrapped in plastic. Michael Unkeen as Sheriff Henry S. Truman. And Kimmy Robertson, I think, is the giveaway here as Lucy. She has a lot of detail that she wants to get out of the way.
Lucy, this is Pete Martell. Lucy, put Harry on the horn.
Sheriff, it's Pete Martell up at the mill. I'm going to transfer to the phone on the table by the red chair. The red chair against the wall. The little table with the lamp on it. The lamp that we moved from the corner. The black phone, not the brown phone.
Morning, Pete. Harry.
She's dead. Wrapped in plastic.
Now, whoa, hold on. Hold on a second, Pete. Where? You stay right there. I'm on my way.
Michael Unkeen as Sheriff Harry S. Truman. Kimmy Robertson with all of the details about all of the phones, all of the chairs and all of the tables in the police station. And Jack Nance as Pete Martell calling in the report of the death of Laura Palmer to his sheriff. And I'm speaking this evening with Mark Frost, co-creator with David Lynch of Twin Peaks. That's quite a set of words, a set of dialogue that you gave, particularly to the Kimmy Robertson character there. As Lucy, Mark.
Well, I think, as you quickly realize, Lucy has the weight of the world on her shoulders and a tremendous amount of responsibility. So she wants to be very clear about every single detail. I mean, as we later reveal, Lucy is enormously important to the overall arc of the story. And but it was a lovely way to slightly leaven the darkness of the moment and also introduce you to another key character.
My understanding is that, I mean, yourself and David Lynch, were supposed to work on a different project. This was, I think, around, you'd seen Eraserhead, and around 1985, you kind of started talking, that project fell through. At what point did even the remotest, you know, seed of the idea of Twin Peaks start to grow between the two of you? And how much water did it have to get, or did it have to get, or did it just gobble up the sunlight and the sun germinate and grow immediately?
No, it took a few years after planting the seeds before we saw any sprouts. I mean, we were working on other projects for 2.5 years before we were approached by a mutual agent of ours who said out of the blue, because we had been working on feature scripts. ABC would like to talk to you about possibly doing a nighttime show. And I told David, I don't know if you're ready, willing, or able for television, but if you let me kind of guide you through this, I think there's maybe a few walls we could bust down on the way to doing this. And he said, that sounds like fun. Let's do it.
So the idea to break down walls was there from the beginning. Now, you had been heavily involved in other TV series previous to this, The $6 Million Man, Hill Street Blues, both of which, you know, iconic in their own ways, but for different reasons, but not in the same realm, I would venture to argue, as Twin Peaks. You wanted to knock down walls along the way. When working on those perhaps more traditional programs like The $6 Million Man, Hill Street Blues, was that already in your mind? You know, was the phrase long-form television in your mind?
The one antecedent that had stayed in my mind since the moment I saw it, and I think it was 1967 or the summer of 68, was when, I wouldn't say it was distributed, but Patrick McGoohan's The Prisoner escaped onto American television for one summer on CBS. And it blew my little 18-year-old mind from here to Mars and back. And there were other things, like the work of Dennis Potter, the singing detective. There were signposts along the way that told me, well, wait a minute, this medium isn't just the cookie cutter formula, let's sell a lot of soft drinks and hamburgers, that it had come to be in the United States. I had this sense that it maybe if we force it to do better, we can reach more people and maybe it sounds crazy, but change the way things are done around here.
Well,
history, that was the notion.
And history has proven you right that you were able to do just that. Were you sitting across the desk from David Lynch, looking at him, asking, I don't know, maybe about damn fine coffee, I'm not sure, when you thought, let's have an FBI agent who says that, who likes damn fine coffee? Because there are large similarities, I think it's safe to say, between FBI Special Agent Dale Cooper, of course, played by the great Kyle MacLachlan, and David Lynch. There are similarities there. You've said this before.
Oh, yes, and there's a healthy dose of me in there, too. It's Dale was a character that came to us almost right away. We knew he needed to be an unconventional FBI agent who was coming into this situation, and it started the moment we first cut to him, when we had this idea, well, what if he's talking into a little micro recorder? That would certainly be an interesting way to deal with all the things that we need to tell people. But it also creates a sense of mystery about him and who's he talking to and who's Diane. The other key component, obviously, is the casting of Kyle MacLachlan. When we wrote the character, we were picturing somebody older. And we didn't tend to cast until the script was finished. And it suddenly struck me, given that David and Kyle had this incredible experience working together on two previous projects, I said to him, what about Kyle? It both hit us, you know, like a 2x4. And we immediately called him, we sent him the script, and before you knew it, you know, it was the three amigos.
Which of you was the person, as in yourself or David, who had a little dictaphone that they pressed record on to record down their ideas? Both of you? Just you? Just him?
Neither of us, actually.
fiction.
That's a fiction. I'm an inveterate note taker, and David tends to scrawl things on a piece of paper and then lose them. So it was pure Dale Cooper, and I got to say, for an FBI agent, it worked like gangbusters.
perfect stuff indeed. I think we need to get, for those who will wonder what Log Lady is even about, we need to get a little bit of context for this character, if you would, before I play a clip of a Log Lady explaining what her logs, the type of knowledge that they might contain within them. This is a Catherine E. Coulson, of course, played Log Lady.
The great Catherine Coulson. Yeah, all right. So here's an easy way to grasp it. because it comes right straight out of Celtic mythology and lore. Hmm. It's the witch in the woods. It's the crone. It's the woman with vision. It's the scary lady in the woods who makes a potion for you. You know, it's she's right down the center of that mythological highway. And the minute you see her, I'm not sure which clip you're going to play, but there was no mistaking. Every town has an eccentric like this. They might not be carrying a log, but I think it was a universal archetype and people really related to her.
Yeah, I think it might be quite, if not the first, certainly a very early scene of Catherine Coulson's as log lady. Kyle MacLachlan as Agent Cooper is in the diner, as usual, looking for some nice pie and damn fine coffee. And Ms. Coulson as log lady comes over to have a little chat with him.
Log lady. Right. Hi. Can I ask her about our log?
Many have.
Evening, Harry.
Irma, like to have you meet Special Agent Dale Cooper.
Federal Bureau of Investigation.
Norma Jennings.
Ms. Jennings, is it true that Laura Palmer used to help you with the Meals on Wheels program, delivering hot dinners to elderly shut-ins?
Yeah, Laura helped organize that program.
Do you have the names of the people on her route?
I can get them for you.
Would you please? And two more pieces of this incredible pie.
Okay.
Man, oh man, you must have the metabolism of a bumblebee.
For your information, I heard you speaking about Laura Palmer.
Yes.
One day, my log will have something to say about this. My log saw something that night.
Really? What did it see?
Ask it. I thought so.
Of course he didn't ask it. He should have asked, of course. He would have got all the information he needed. That is Catherine Coulson as Log Lady, Kyle MacLachlan as Agent Cooper in the scene from Twin Peaks.
And the series would have ended after about 45 minutes, so it's a good thing he didn't ask her.
Yes, that is true. Mark Frost, the co-creator with David Lynch of Twin Peaks. And this is 35th anniversary year of existence and its entirety to be screened on Mubi later this week, bringing in, I'm sure, a whole new set of fans. Mark is speaking with me this evening. The easy presumption here, Mark, is, oh, well, Mark Frost was the guy from, you know, traditional format TV, and he knew how to get the narrative driven scenes and narrative driven arc of an hour long episode. He knew how to do that. And then David Lynch could bring in his mad imagery and his surrealism. But I'm guessing from what you've said, there's a fair amount of the surrealism, if we count Log Lady in that, or even perhaps the dream world that comes in later on in season two without giving anything away, when a giant speaks to the Kyle MacLachlan, or when giant speaks to the Kyle MacLachlan character. I'm guessing a lot of that came from you too.
Well, you know, sure it did. I mean, we would start playing tennis together, and before you knew it, it was like Alcaraz and Sinner yesterday at the French Open. We incredible rallies. And my background as a playwright, as a lover of fantastic fiction, of horror, of everything from Jules Verne to Alexander Dumas to Sean O'Casey. I mean, I brought all of that to the table. And yeah, it's easy to say I was the word guy. He was the image guy. But once we got onto the court, it was all hands on deck, and all of us was on display, both of us.
I have to pick up on the fact that you mentioned Sean O'Casey there. What particular aspects of Twin Peaks do you credit to Sean O'Casey being Sean O'Casey inspired?
Well, I think he's in the forefront of what we might now call the magical realism movement of the English-speaking world before it became something we more quickly associate with, you know, Latin American writers. Mm. There was a poetic realism in all of his work, as there was in Eugene O'Neill, another Irish playwright. That was my mother's milk growing up. You know, I felt that this was the world that could inhabit network television if we only had an opening to do it. And they gave us an opening.
Man, and so, but how much fighting did you have to do with the executives of ABC? I mean, I'm thinking of the fact that, you know, two seasons in, it's a huge success and dumpf, it's gone. I mean,
yeah.
was that one of these bean counter, or did it feel like a bean counter type of decision to you? How annoyed were you?
Well, yeah, it was entirely that. This was a family-owned business at the time, ABC. It was before they sold them to Disney. And they were arch conservatives. They were also languishing in third place in a three-horse race for about the last 5 years. So it was a casino that was running out of money, and they were willing to take a big bet. And that's why they came to us. Mm. They didn't come to us looking for another, you know, love boat. We said, okay, we're going to do it, but listen, you got to trust us. The only time they ever tried to give us a note, we had turned in the pilot. The executive took a list out of his pocket and said, now, would you like to hear some of the thoughts we had about the script? And David said, no.
I love it.
It was a key moment because, I mean, they could have, like, you know, sounded the alarm and put the portcullis down and raised the drawbridge and started firing at us. But he very quietly and meekly put the note back in his pocket. And that was that, you know, you put down a marker like that and the other guy better live up to it.
Absolutely. But what a wonderful answer. No, I don't want to hear your thoughts on it right now. There must be a certain bittersweetness in the midst of it all, Mark Frost, the fact that David Lynch, of course, died in January of this year. I'm sure, you know, you were more than just professional colleagues. There was a lot more between the two of you than that. Is there a bittersweet feeling to all of this celebration of the 35th year and this release on MUBI?
Well, naturally. I mean, you know, when I've always said, you know, I'd never had a writing partner who I collaborated with the way that I did this. David had neither, and I haven't since. And in a funny way, it's like a bromance. It's like a marriage. It's like you get to know each other while you're hanging out to do all this writing. And we spent countless hours doing it. Maybe better than you know anybody. So that creates a kind of bond and a sense of purpose and brotherhood that there's just no way to duplicate that. So his loss is very, very keenly felt. And it's hard to imagine he's gone. I think about him every day. And I think given that he had a spiritual life that was deep and I think kind of profound, that he was at peace with the idea of leaving his body. I hope that's how it happened for him. And I get little signals sometimes that he may still be around. So
what kind of signals? What kind of signals, Mark?
Well, I'll hear his voice in my head. I mean, how's that? You know,
yeah.
I'll be thinking something, and it isn't like I'm just remembering something he said. It's like he's commenting on it. So it's not quite Blythe's spirit, but it's sort of on that road.
Well, you may be experiencing the loss, and I'm sure it is very difficult for you and all of David's colleagues, family and friends. But you also can experience the legacy, and particularly the legacy of Twin Peaks. I did start out by saying at the very beginning of this, why was it the success that it was? But perhaps you have begun to be able to, at this point in time, to be able to measure the legacy of it. That idea of long form TV that is so omnipresent now in a wonderful type of way. What do you see, Mark Frost, as the legacy of that co-creation of yours and David Lynch's Twin Peaks?
I always told everybody while we were making the show, I know we've all done work before that we just did for a payday. That's part of the business. It's part of the industry. This is different. We're making this to last. Whether it will or not, it's entirely up to somebody else. It's up to the people out there. But if we try to give it that feeling and we believe that it's possible, I sound like I'm leading a self-help group, but... That was something I very carefully and purposefully wanted to instill in people. And I think that had a lot to do with it.
Was it David Lynch who just said into your head, you sound like you're leading a self-help group?
That might have been his voice. Although David, you know, David was a true believer. He loved being in Twin Peaks. We loved being there together. And thank goodness people around the world still love being there, you know, 35 years later.
Mark Frost, it is such a pleasure and privilege to have spoken with you this evening. Thank you for being with us.
Sean, my pleasure entirely. Hope you have a great day, what remains of it there, and best wishes to you.
That's Mark Frost, co-creator of Twin Peaks, and Twin Peaks Seasons 1 and 2 will be available to stream from Mubi on June the 13th, Friday the 13th. What other date for Twin Peaks? You're listening to Monday Night's Arena. At just 23, saxophonist and composer Emma Ravitch has already made a serious mark on the jazz world. Born in rural Devon and classically trained on violin, she discovered jazz at 12, picked up the saxophone at 16, quickly making up for lost time with marathon practice sessions. Since then, she's released two acclaimed albums, Incantation and Chroma. Her current album is called Big Visit. Both of her previous albums won multiple awards, and she signed to the leading German label ACT. She has an unusual approach to sound, as she sees music as colour and believes jazz is a real nerd-friendly genre. Head of her Irish tour with Music Network, I'm delighted to be joined in studio this evening by Emma Ravitch. Yeah, well, you enjoy the real nerd-friendly genre. Was it some inner nerd in you that kind of found yourself in jazz?
Oh, definitely. I think, I mean, it can be a negative, I think, but I think the idea of being a nerd, of being just really interested in the details of things and loving just finding out more, that's something I would definitely apply to myself. And jazz is one of those genres of music that there's just always more to find out. There's always more to know. There's always more to enjoy and aim for as a listener and as a player. So I think, you know, that definitely feels like a home to me.
Yeah, and I think it's unusual enough, maybe not, maybe I'm wrong, for somebody to come to jazz at quite a young, as young an age as you did. I mean, you were about 11 or 12, like barely a teenager even at that stage. Where were you hearing it?
Well, it was actually one very specific situation. I used to go to this fantastic summer school in South Devon called the Dartington International Summer School, which is sadly no more. But I went there for quite a few years. I went playing violin, I tried composing some music, and the brilliant thing about that place was there were all these different kinds of music going on. Always, you know, unexpected kinds of music. There was improvisation to film, there was jazz, there was Brazilian music, and there was this one big band concert that really made an impression on me.
And what specifically do you remember about that big concert that kind of made you sit up and say, "Ooh, that's interesting music"?
I think it was just the sound, the kind of force and the colour of that sound. You know, hearing so many saxophones and so many brass instruments in one place wasn't something I'd had access to before, I suppose. And it really just, it sounded like nothing I'd ever heard before, and I immediately wanted to see if I could kind of get involved in that.
Yeah, because I think up until that point you had been playing piano, violin, maybe clarinet was in there, but nothing in the brassy, or as the saxophones are often referred to, nothing in the horns area of the band.
Yeah, that's right. No, it was definitely a little different for me, but I had this moment of thinking, okay, this is it. This is my sound. This is the instrument that I connect with. And from then it was sort of full steam ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I think you were in that classical world, I'm guessing, particularly with the violin. The clarinet might have had a little bit of a crossover into the jazz area. But the saxophone is a long distance, not too far from the clarinet. It's a long distance from the violin. It's a whole new process. It's a wind instrument. It's not a stringed instrument. So how difficult was it in those early days just to get that initial sound? Clarinet would have helped with that, I guess.
Yeah, the clarinet definitely helped. I think, funnily enough, though, it felt incredibly natural. I just had this moment when I managed to get my hands on a saxophone for the first time where I played the first few notes and I had a feeling of arriving at where I was supposed to be. You know, not that I sounded great straight away, certainly not. But, you know, the process of making the sound felt very natural, and I could imagine myself really, you know, wanting to spend hours and hours on this.
And which of the saxophones, which voice, tenor, alto, or soprano, baritone, what sax were you holding at the time?
It was an alto. I knew that I wanted to play the tenor, but generally people advise you to start on the alto. But it wasn't long. It was maybe less than a year before I managed to finally get my hands on a tenor. And that was another point of like, oh, okay, this is it. This is the right kind of sound for
me. So you were in the right house when you played the saxophone. Generally, you were in the right room when you got to the
tenor.
Let's have a listen to a track from, I don't know which of the albums this is from. I'm sure you'll remember which. The Oak Tree is on which of the albums, that song.
The Oak Tree is actually an as yet unrecorded.
Oh, there
yes.
you go.
So well, very exciting premiere.
We have a recording of it that you very kindly gave to us. I'm thinking, oh, well, Rural Devon must have fed into The Oak Tree. Let's have a listen and you can tell me afterwards whether it did or not. Sorry to cut you off in your prime, Emma Ravitch. That's a first time hearing for you, even, you were saying, Emma, as you were listening there to The Oak Tree, new recording from Emma Ravitch, who's heading out on a Music Network tour later in the month. I'll give details of the dates and venues a little bit later on. So, yes, I didn't hear a lot of Rural Devon in that oak tree there. So it wasn't that type of inspiration, was it?
No. Well, actually, the title came from a slightly different place. So one of my big musical heroes, and I'm lucky to have had her as a mentor, as well as the great piano player and composer Nicky Isles from England. And she kind of taught me a bit about composition, about piano, and many other things. And when I was just starting out my studies with her, I played some of her big band music when she was doing a project at the Royal Academy of Music, and she had this piece called Wild Oak, which was a kind of musical tribute to the great Gerry Allen, who was someone that had inspired her. And I thought, why not kind of, I guess, go a bit further on the oak theme and write something for Nicky? So that's where The Oak Tree came from.
And obviously talking about that mentorship that she gave you, and you're referring to her oak tree, or her oak song, if you like, talking about her mentor.
Yeah.
When you took over, when you started into the saxophone, I mean, you're obviously playing at a highly proficient level now, but you started at 16, so that's not that long ago.
No.
And here you are now with three albums under your belt at this point in time. I talked about marathon practice sessions. Mm. How marathon? What length marathons were you running musically?
Well, I'd say in the years when I was really studying, so when I was at Cheetham School of Music in Manchester and then later the Royal Academy of Music in London, the first maybe 4 or 5 years of that, I was practicing between 8 and 10 hours a day.
That's a lot.
It was probably too much. And during COVID, similarly, I'd sometimes practice up to 11 or 12, which, to be honest, was definitely too much, and I wouldn't advise that. But we had nothing else to do, right? So, but it was. I had this feeling of wanting to catch up, to be perfectly honest with you. I felt that I should have started earlier, and I felt like, oh my goodness, I'm never going to be able to keep up with my peers who started a bit earlier. So that's kind of what fueled that. And also just a real passion for it. I found it so interesting. So while I don't have quite that much time to practice anymore, I do still really enjoy a good long practice session when I can fit it in.
We should also give credit to your... I was asking later where you were hearing the jazz. We should give some credit to your dad's iPod, which dates him, of course, very quickly, if he had an iPod full of music.
Yeah.
So how eclectic was that mix that you were listening to on that iPod?
Oh, it was pretty eclectic. I think my favourite stuff was Avril Lavigne.
Yeah, Avril Lavigne, but all sorts of things on it.
All sorts. AC/DC, classical music, prepared piano. I think there was this great Turkish pianist, Fazıl Say.
By prepared piano, just explain to people what we're talking about. Instead of the keys,
well, there was
the insides
keys
are messed with.
There was the keys, but also experimenting with dampening the strings so you get that kind of thudding kind of sound, more even kind of percussive sounds from the piano. And I'd never heard anything like that. I remember listening to a bit of that. All sorts, really.
And one thing that strikes me in the move from classical to jazz, and we were just heading into a big solo there, because you can hear in the early part of The Oak Tree, we can hear that it's set out with the band, and then it heads off into this solo. Improvisation, I know there are cadenzas and all of those things. Most of those cadenzas in big classical concertos are now written out, and people play what's written on the page in front of them.
Yeah.
How difficult was it to put your mindset into the let go and just improvise?
Oh, it's really hard. I mean, I think especially when you've really got into the mindset of getting things right or wrong, which is a kind of necessary evil when it comes to playing written music. There is the aspect of did I or did I not correctly play what's on the page. That's very difficult to let go of, including in situations when there is no written music, you know, where you're trying to come up with a solo, say something new, or just even experiment a little bit. It can be really hard to let go of the feeling of parameters, you know, of like, oh, hang on, was that good? Was it bad? Was it right? And the reality is that when you're improvising, it's less clear whether it was correct.
There is no wrong and right.
It becomes more subjective.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mentioned, I think I talked about colour, but I think synesthesia is where people literally see notes as colours. But chromesthesia, which is your particular situation, explain that to us and how it feeds into your playing and your composition.
Well, for me, it simply is that music and colour have quite a strong relationship. So when I'm playing music, in particular, when I'm improvising, I get to a point, and I really love this, when I'm able to get to this mindset where I don't have to think about notes. I just think about the colours that I'm hearing and seeing and trying to respond to that in a more kind of instant way rather than a logical way. Because I think, you know, there is a logical element in there, of course. You know which note you're playing, you know what the chords are doing. But sometimes I find I can get away from that and feel like you're almost sort of painting with the sound rather than thinking, oh, well, maybe I should play this note on this chord, although there's definitely a place for that. But yeah, there's a visual element to it, I suppose, and that can be kind of help you be more free.
Any sense of what colours, what visual, what images were in your head in the composition of and in the playing of Middle Ground?
Middle Ground was definitely a light blue colour, a kind of light blue with certain elements of this kind of quite delicate yellow in there as well. For sure. I mean, it's like it's this E major type situation. On the saxophone, it's D major concert, but it's a harmonic major mode, which is a little bit technical perhaps, but you'd hear it just in that there's this one note in the melody that doesn't quite feel like it fits with this kind of happy feeling.
And is that the blue?
Note.
Is that the blue or the yellow? Would
that's
you
the
say?
Yellow note, funnily enough.
That's the yellow note. The blue, because there's a real comfort, I must say, as you listen to the bluey, smoky kind of quality within this. So now I'm going to peel my ears and listen for the yellow as we finish up with Middle Ground. And as I say, I'll give, when we finish this, a little section from this up, I will give the details out of Emma's upcoming tour with Music Networks. Emma, thanks for being with us this evening. And this is Middle Ground, blue and yellow. Mm-hmm. And that little taste of Middle Ground from saxophonist Emma Ravitch. That's from her 2023 album Chroma. Emma continues her Music Network tour through until June the 13th. She'll be at Sugar Club in Dublin on Tuesday. She'll be at St John's Theatre and Arts Centre in Listowel on Wednesday, Triskell Arts Centre in Cork on Thursday, and at the Riverbank Arts Centre in Newbridge, County Kildare on Friday. You can find out full details on musicnetwork.ie. The Pipeworks International Organ and Choral Festival celebrates its 45th anniversary this year when it returns to Dublin on the 18th of June. Claudia Grinnell is one of the musicians in the programme, an English organist, director of music at Bertie St Edmunds Cathedral. She'll be playing everything from Bach to a medley from The Sound of Music at the festival, and delighted that Claudia joins me now on the line. I often wonder, Claudia, at what point, and I'm guessing it starts on the piano, but at what point does the pianist say, nah, one keyboard, 51, whatever it is, number of keys on the keyboard, nah, couldn't be bothered with that. I want two or three, maybe four manuals of keys. I want loads of stops that I can have those big pipes making sounds out at the side. And I want to use my feet. That's what I want to do instead of playing the piano. How does that happen? Well, how did it happen for you?
I mean, you've just outlined it, haven't you? Who wouldn't want to? But I started on the piano, as you predicted. I joined a little village church choir with some new friends when we moved house when I was about 10. And the organist at this little church recognised that I could play the piano and had quite long legs and could probably reach the pedals. And it really was as kind of coincidental as that. And this organist kind of did all the behind-the-scenes work, got me lessons, got me my first organ scholarship, and it went from there, really.
And it's interesting, obviously, most organs are in a church. That's where we're going to find most of them. There are some in concert halls, and there are some, perhaps there were certainly some in cinemas in times of yore. But is it essentially, when we talk about the organ, is it essentially sacred music that we're talking about?
I think it sort of depends which bit of it you're looking at. I mean, my job now, yes, is almost entirely sacred music, which is why when I come to do recitals, I tend to go for a program which is a bit more theatre and cinema based. But the organ, as you said, has had roots in the cinema. There are kind of various show pieces that exist for it, but being an instrument that was kind of built for churches, a lot of that repertoire does have its roots in the sacred, yes.
And also, one of the things that interests me, we were just speaking with a young jazz musician, saxophonist Emma Ravitch, and we were talking about that move from, you know, classical music. She started on the violin, and how you move from the strictures of written music that's written down to these moments of improvisation. Of course, the organist has been doing that for centuries, because quite often in a sacred situation or in a ceremonial situation or in some kind of liturgical situation, you have to fill in the gaps when somebody might be walking from one part of the church to another, or there might be a procession, and you're looking in the mirror to see, I can't stop until they get up onto the altar or until they get wherever they're going.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, there are traditions, like in France, there are huge traditions around improvisation, where it's a really key part of the service, and actually that's what the organists are known for, especially at, for example, you know, Notre Dame in Paris. And we do it in our jobs all the time. Probably half of the service is us improvising, as you say, to cover things. It can be as boring as, you know, someone's put their hymn book down, has got to go and get it before they come back and carry on the service, and you've got to make it sound like a, you know, interesting liturgical moving moment.
All right, let us listen to some pieces that you've chosen, and you playing, I think, well, certainly you playing in the first one. This has a lovely story to it. When I saw Lloyd Webber, I thought, who's W. Lloyd Webber? And of course, he is the daddy of both Julian and Andrew Lloyd Webber. A good family line there, clearly.
Absolutely.
Tell me a little bit about the piece, because I think it's actually not just about the father, as in the composer, W. Lloyd Webber. It's also about the mother of the two boys.
Oh, I didn't know that at all. That sounds like extra info that you've got. But the piece is beautiful. It starts from almost nothing, just a single stop. And it builds up one by one, stop by stop, to this huge climax in the middle and then all the way back down again at the end. And I know that when William Lloyd Webber was composing, his fluences were a bit old-fashioned. It was Sibelius, Franck, Rachmaninoff. But he really stuck with his own voice, and I think it's a really beautiful example of the English romantic repertoire.
All right, well, let's have a listen. It's written for violin and organ, and my little piece of extra information is that...
Oh, beautiful, excellent.
Lloyd Webber composed this for his own wedding service because his wife... the woman who became his wife, was a violinist. So there you go. There's a bit of information for you to put in your pipe and smoke. Let's have a listen to that wedding piece then from W. Lloyd Webber. Benedictus, the title of that piece from William Lloyd Webber, father of Andrew and Julian Lloyd Webber, and it is a piece for violin and organ. William Lloyd Webber himself was an organist, and his wife, Jean, was a violinist, and hence he composed that piece for their wedding day. And speaking with me this evening is Claudia Grinnell, Director of Music at Bury St Edmunds Cathedral, who will be part of the Pipeworks International Organ Festival. It's quite unusual, really, Claudia, am I right in thinking, to hear the organ in that kind of duet position with one other instrument?
Yeah, quite unusual. It's not something we come across a lot, and it's fun to do when we do get to do it.
And I was, I just presumed, the organ will just, they'll pull out a few of those extra stops, have the big pipes at the side going and drown out the soloist. But no, a very well-mannered organist there. Was that you playing?
It's not me there, no, but I can be well-mannered when I need to.
Yeah, all right. So, see, it's the City of London Sinfonia, actually, who are playing there. You came from a music, I'm talking about the Lloyd Webbers there. You came from a musical family yourself. I think both your grandmothers and your great-grandmother, all on the keyboard, but piano.
Absolutely, that's right. So they taught me initially. It very much skipped my parents and my sister, who are very loyal supporters, but are slightly baffled that I've managed to end up in this career.
Yeah, I believe your sister on the piano practice was like many's a child at piano practice.
Yes.
Shall you embarrass her?
She did 10 minutes.
Was it your mum who put on, or your grandmother who put on a timer saying, you have to do your 10 minutes and then you can go. And the minute the timer went, she was gone.
That's absolutely right. She'd just... hands off, mid-piece, off she went. And then she'd sit down and go, well, I don't know why I can't play it. Well, it's a bit obvious, I think. Yeah.
And you were, of course, you then sat down. Could you be got up from the piano?
Yeah, I had to be banned from practicing before school. Otherwise, we wouldn't have left.
Yeah. Well, look, I suppose that there are worse complaints than that. So at your performance, you have a lunchtime recital in Sandford Parish Church in Ranelagh, and you're also giving a masterclass afterwards. As part of the recital then, what sort of music will you be playing, Claudia? Will it be across the repertoire?
It is, yes. I've got a bit of film music, piece from... 1940s film The First of the Few, which is Walton's Spitfire Prelude, a bit of opera, so some Lohengrin and some Aida, the Lloyd Webber, the very famous Bach, Toccata and Fugue in D minor, a medley from The Sound of Music, and a lovely piece which was written by a girl I went to school next door to in Wolverhampton, and she's grown up also musical, and she's gone off into the composing world, and that's called Light Revealing.
Well, let's finish up by listening to a little bit of Light Revealing from Grace Evangeline Mason is her name, your pal from Wolves.
That's right.
And this one is you playing, I do believe.
Excellent.
Thanks for being with us this evening, Claudia. Thanks so much.
Thanks.
Light Revealing, the music there of Grace Evangeline Mason, the friend of Claudia Grinnell, who was playing that piece there and beforehand telling us about her performance, her upcoming performance at Sanford Parish Church, 3 p.m. on Friday the 20th. Sorry, 1:10 p.m. for her performance, 3 p.m. for her masterclass at Sanford Parish Church. Pipeworks International Organ and Choral Festival takes place in Dublin from the 18th through to the 22nd of June. Pipeworks.ie for full details. And that is our lot for this Monday evening. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields researched. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Ruth Kennington was on sound this evening, and the programme was produced by Reg Luby. Back with you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, here on RT Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the news.